This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 10th of December, 1951. The title of this lecture is Dead Men's Goals, Part 2. This lecture is 66 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
I want to talk to you now about the resolution of cases which have afflicted themselves with this fashion. I'm about three quarters of the way through on the Dianetics workbook. That will be ready, I think, for the conference right after Christmas. And it takes this up to some degree. I'll be interesting to test it out because some preacher is going to get a hold of this and be working it very unsuspectingly because it doesn't turn out the way they think it does. It's rigged in such a way that after they put down all the future goals they have and all the things they are afraid of, all the present goals they have, immediates, and all the things they're afraid of in the present, and all the things they're afraid of and the goals they've had in the past, then they're going to find out these belong to other people. And that is approximately the system by which you work this thing out. Let's take one individual, and we find out that he is making a terrible failure as a, let's say salesman. Oh, he's an awful failure as a salesman. And it's caused him a great deal of concern that he fails as a salesman. Now we come to find out, we look his personality over and so forth, and we find out this fellow's a pretty good trumpet player. And he says, why don't you play a trumpet? Well, that's not steady. A lot of other excuses and so forth, he couldn't go along in that. Now, theoretically, you'd look back on the track for times when he'd been discouraged as a trumpet player, and you'll find those, you'll find a lot of them. And then for some reason or other, he won't go on playing the trumpet. Of course, as an auditor, you can become impatient with him and hit him or something. But this doesn't produce good results either. Now, the point is that this person is being a salesman. That is why he is not being a trumpet player. I get that point. You want to rehabilitate an artist or rehabilitate an individual in any line, don't concentrate on what they are had an ambition to be and try to rehabilitate that so much as you would go over and try to find out why they are being what they are being that makes their ambition seem small and pale. It's very indirect. In other words, this person is being a bad salesman, and he always wanted to be a trumpet player. And you realize, in just looking him over, he'd be happy in being a trumpet player. He's unhappy in being a salesman. Well, what's this all about? Let's make it unnecessary for him to be a salesman before we try to make a trumpet player out of it. Take an assay of his goals, in other words, and you'll find out that he is being a salesman because somebody else who is still alive, or, but not very much so, or somebody who is dead wanted to be a salesman. Now, you'll get this strange one sometimes. This individual wants to be a trumpet player, and he is a trumpet player, but he doesn't like being a trumpet player. You got that? He's obviously, his ambition is to be a trumpet player, but he doesn't like being a trumpet player. He'd rather do anything than be a trumpet player. Let's just find this one. His natural talent was playing a trumpet. And then he took over the ambition of somebody who died to be a trumpet player, which alloyed his own ambition. One always has a tendency to regret sooner or later noble gestures. Now that seems rather complicated to you at first glance.
Because it's too simple. This is a coincidence. Here is character A, his goal, and if here's our pre-clear, B, his goal. Now A comes up along the line up here and fails markedly or dies. Character B is going along just fine. This business of somebody, by the way, wanting to be something or do something because they admired somebody who did something, that's a lot of malarkey. I mean, little kids, 2 years of age, know what they want to be. They're not emulating somebody. All right. B here is going along fine with his goal, his own goal. Now, all of a sudden, this person dies. He wants to carry this life continuum forward for A, and he has to carry it forward with his own goal. He'll hate being a trumpet player. After a while, he will regret this. But did you ever see anybody who was being noble, who was being martyred? You know? Life. I go on as I can. I do my best. Of course, it's hard, but somehow I manage. You ever run into anybody like this? None of you has a parent who does this. Oh, say not so. It's an actual attitude. They're actually doing just that. It's not a pose. They're doing that. So this fellow now goes over and is a trumpet player. Life is hard, but I am able. I managed to play the trumpet. I managed to keep going somehow. Whereas his attitude toward trumpet playing was, beat me, daddy, 8 to the bar, hurrah, 3 cheers, I'm a good trumpeter, zingity bang, like to be with the boys in the band and so forth. Now he's got to be noble about it. You'll ruin it. I ran a writer one time who had done just fine as a writer, just swell, and it was all mixed up. And I never knew, really, at the time I was working this case, how the case resolved. I ran certain grief charges off the case, and the case then resolved. Until recently, I didn't know why that case had resolved. He was being the life continuum, the ambition continuum, for 3 separate dead people who had the ambition to be writers. Plus his own ambition to be a writer. And he was being noble 3 times and himself once. And it finally bogged him down completely. And the reason people bog down on talents, ambitions, and abilities when they are a life continuum of some other person is because, not because of the nobility involved, that would be all right, but because they're sitting on grief charges. So the grief charges gets all mixed up. The grief for A gets all mixed up in trumpet playing. You see how this works? Therefore, the rehabilitation of an individual definitely must address the goals of the dead around him. If you're doing industrial counseling, well, that's a horrible word. If you're doing Dianetic personnel work, let's get something done. Dianetic personnel work. It would be very much to your interest to find out whether or not this fellow that you're hiring on a fairly high level of position, you know this job's going to be important, junior executive job or something of the sort, to find out if he's doing what he wants to do. All you'd have to ask him is, who's dead? He'd look at you rather surprised, and he would say, well, grandfather, Aunt Bertha, Agnes, Rover, horse I had once, mother. Oh, what's that got to do with it? Which one of these wanted to be a junior executive? Well, it sits there blankly for a moment. Well, my mother was a business type woman.
You say, what was your ambition? What year did your mother die?
Oh, mother died in 1942.
What was your ambition in 1938?
His face will glow for a moment, and he'll say, I wanted to play drum. Well, she always wanted to be a junior executive, so what? I realized that I can do this job. Sure, he can, in a sort of a halfway basis, with a grief chart sitting at the bottom. Don't hire him. He's a failure. He may not be a failure right then. Not right at that moment. But if you plan on a high-level job like that being filled for a few years and being filled happily, you realize that this individual, the more he works at that job, get this one, the more he re-stimulates the grief charge until he fails. Grim, huh? Now, actually, sometimes the person, you don't have to blow grief charge. If you just ask a person to assay, what were the ambitions of all the people they know who have failed or who are dead? And you'll get the darndest hodgepodge. And the fellow will all of a sudden start integrating it into his own life, how he has behaved with regard to these various items. Now, let's take something which is very interesting to us. This is not a nice subject. This is a subject which is practically taboo, but a subject which is making an awful lot of guys unhappy, an awful lot of girls unhappy, homosexuality. Why? Why do you get an emphasis on a shifted sex line? Well, we take mother, who was very dominant. Why is it that we find a dominant mother or a very dominant father? When we find a dominant father for the girl or a dominant mother for the guy, what do we got? We have an interesting setup. When mama kicks off, we have a second dynamic continuum. Already a tendency toward a second dynamic continuum by the dominance of that parent. And when mama kicks off, it gets confirmed. But during his own lifetime and so forth, living under this dominance, appointing mother cause, being in mother's valence because of such dominance, mother has already failed, you see, back here. Failed. Mama's very dominant, but she has had some bad failures, such as a divorce. And you will get a life continuum extending from a parent's failure. See? Mama lived up here and got divorced from then on, so forth. He feels very sympathetic because of mama's divorce. He moves over. It's a valence problem, isn't it? Standard routine valence problem. That's the way it happens. When mama dies, this fellow just bloom. Horrible. Now, this is a dominant father. Very dominant father. This is a girl that's liable to go in that direction. You're liable to get a similar setup. When he dies, she gets in bad way. Very, very bad way. That's what I mean by goals. You see, there's a goal on every dynamic. What do you want to be? What do you want the human race to be? What do you want children to be? What do you want your own second dynamic to be? What do you want the community to be? What do you want animals to do and be? What do you want the physical universe to amount to? How should God act? It's a goal too, you know. Well, you just start sorting out the dead men, and down amongst the dead men, you'll find them lying. And here's this individual who natively, at the age of 2, would have been very, very happy and cheerful to have been a streetcar conductor. Finding out at the age of 10 with the failure of Uncle Bill that he now has to be a painter, and botching his life up from there on until he is 18, at which time Papa dies, but Papa was the president of a trust company, so now he has to be an office boy in the trust company. And you'll find this individual doing billiard shots in life. Carom, 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 changing profession, changing interest, and life itself saying, hey boy, whoa, will you please follow along one course so we can keep track of you? Why do you keep failing all the time? What's the idea? Well, you see, if he goes into the valence of somebody who failed, he will fail. To carry out the life continuum of somebody who failed means that one fails, too. So you have to carry out the whole continuum. You have to like pork chops, you have to, so on. There's a special set of rules of all the things that you have to do to continue the life of somebody who has either failed or dead. Oh, yeah, very interesting. Bunch of nonsense. It's an effort to keep the person alive. It may even be only based upon the aberration that an individual lives but once. Only some aberration of that magnitude could come in and land one in our laps as that as heavy as this life continuum thing. There's a great anxiety in a person's mind if he feels that he has reached the age, let us say, of 35 and has not yet, quote, lived, unquote. I remember when I was 21, I was one of the most desperate boys you ever met. Life was slipping through my fingers. And I couldn't grab hold of it. And obviously I would never have another chance. That's what everybody said. Must be true, must be true. They couldn't be wrong. Everybody said so. You know, past deaths couldn't come out unless you could prove them as easy as you can. But I wonder why we were ever very reticent about them. I talked to somebody about this subject once in a while, mention it. Casually, out of the blue. They don't know anything about Dynex, son of your son. I get an astonishing result. Yeah? I don't get, oh, no. I get, yeah? That's very interesting. They're saying with that, yeah, that they say, you mean to say I'm going to have another chance at it? Now, that's an awful lot of aberration, by the way. Because what's aberration? The single arbitrary in aberration is time. And if you convince an individual he's never going to go back over any kind of ground he's gone over before, he's never going to get another chance to be a young man, he's never going to get a chance to be a little girl and choose her own life, never going to get any other parents than he has, never going to get anything but what he's got. He's made his bed and he's got to lie in it. It's a bed of roses, but they're mostly thorns. You tell a fellow this, you convince him of this, and of course he'll get into a state of anxiety. Only an untruth, by the way, can get a person into a state of anxiety. A complete untruth is necessary. People get into a state of anxiety for lack of data or for untrue data. So your net result is you have individuals, particularly people in their early 20s, in a terrible furrow. Their minds cannot settle to an ambition because they think they're shooting these dice just once. And you take a fellow around a dice table and you say, all right, now all the dice you were ever going to play is right here, and we are going to give you one pass. You get to shoot the dice once. If you win on this one pass, you're going to be easy and comfortable, and life is going to be a song. And if you lose, you're going to be a hobo, bud, and that'll be the end of your life. Do you see this gambler's thing? Well, that's most people facing life. And that very anxiety is similar to the golfer who goes out and he wraps his hands around the club and he's read all the rule books and he knows he only gets one shot and then it goes on the scorecard. He doesn't get that shot again, ever. And if he's convinced enough that this game is that serious and it's that important, dub, the ball goes bounce, bounce, bounce. Not 220 yards down the fairway, it's still there. Then, of course, because of the stress of the valuation on the thing, he sees the ball has only moved 3 inches, he goes into apathy. He stays there.
This is, we don't see a very
clean world around as far as this trial and error is concerned.
This is the serious button, don't you see? This is a part of the serious button on an educational level. This says, well, you only, seriousness says, life is serious, life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is the goal. And you look at this and you say, gee, it's serious. I'm never going to get a chance to be a young man again. Never. This one love is the only love. And boy, it's been a sloppy one. I'm old now. I will never have a chance to write that great American novel. Apathy. Guy takes off. Well, I don't know who dealt the cards this way. Some thousands of years ago, but they were obviously dealt this way. And here in Dianetics, we've broken out a new deck. We found out that the old cards were marked. I don't like to play with readers myself, unless I've got a better set. Now, there's the serious button right there. They say, well, you live once. You don't have to add to it. What you do in this life is going to be kept in a big book, and it's going to be written down, every single thing that you do, that particularly the bad things, and we are going to burn you for eternity if the marks come up wrong. You know, it's perfectly true that there are books. Everything you do is written down in the book. You're the book. There you sit. But you get what this does on the serious button. This takes some of the smash out of that button. All of a sudden, the guy relaxes and rolls out the typewriter and says, well, probably won't be till next lifetime I'll ever find a publisher that's white enough to publish this thing, but I might as well get started now, and I'll sort of have the idea kicking around. Maybe you ought to bury it someplace and go dig it up. Be sure and keep these manuscript files in good order. I may get processed into remembering where I stuck them. It's very interesting that individuals occasionally turn up and tell me rather excitedly, hey, couldn't we go find some buried treasure by running off a death or something and a buried treasure? Well, why don't we? So I say, I did. They say, you did? Well, wouldn't the foundation like to have $100 billion in doubloons or something of the sort? I say, no. No, we're worried about Dianetics. We're not much interested in money because, you see, you got money, you have to spend all your time protecting the money. You know what happened the last time you had money. And you don't get any research work done and nobody gets well. And you get as much money as you need. And they say, well, wait a minute, you said you did this. Yeah. The only trouble is that the stuff was on a ledge of the seafloor, which went out from Port Royal about a quarter of a mile, and a tidal wave came along and completely knocked the whole thing to pieces, and it's not there anymore. But charts are different. Well, how do you know they're different? Well, I'll tell you why they're different. It's because I went down to the library. And I took the chart I had, and I compared it to a chart of Jamaica. It's the chart of Jamaica for 1658. Only the chart for Jamaica of 1949 shows that that whole point there has been wiped off by a hurricane. So there's not much we can do. Well, supposing you buried some treasure in this life and you could pick it up in the next life and you could do this and you could do that. Yes, yes, we could be very platitudinous now and say, yeah, there's some treasure you can fix up in this life. You get yourself up the tone scale so when you're born again,
Another thing is you can straighten the world out so it's a little easier to live in next time. You know, you have a vested interest in this society. Could I sell you a piece of tomorrow? You would definitely do. Supposing, how would you like to go through the childhood that you've just gone through? Rough deal, huh? Well, if you don't want to go through that childhood again, I can tell you what you can do. You can make darn sure that the public school systems for the first, second, and third grade, your next parents, includes a good intensive course in how to raise children, Dianetics. We better make sure that it's right. Very simple. Young man, there is probably going to be somebody's pop that's right here someday. It's a gorgeous world, really. Look at it. Well, in the resolution, then, of cases, you will find there's one button above all other buttons that is an interesting button. It does tricks. It's the serious button. When you start to consider it very, very serious, you're on your way. You're on your way. An individual who considers driving a car serious business, he can consider it so seriously that he'll have nothing but wrecks. There's where serious goes. Serious goes down into to accident band, upset, mistakes, and so forth. And it drops out of sight in that direction. How serious can you get? Dead. That's how serious you can get. That's not very serious now. All right. Then there isn't anything that's terribly serious about the line. You take somebody who considers things in a very serious light. This person will take responsibility, but he won't execute it. In other words, his level of taking hold of responsibility, his ability to handle responsibility is very poor, even when he says he's a very responsible fellow. You see, he considers it too serious. You know, the biggest gag I ever saw pulled is a first sergeant of Marines. He's not serious, but boy, he sure gets things done. It's an act. He knows it's an act. Most anybody who's getting anything done really, really knows that it's not blood. It's a game. And as long as they know it's a game, you ever see a college football team down there? They start hitting the line, they get broken legs, and they grit their teeth, and they're in there to do and die for dear old... their employers. But it's a game. And that's important. As long as life has the level of being a game, you can play it. But when it no longer has the level of being a game, it plays you. It's the difference between being the chess player and the pawn. And the difference between being the chess player and the pawn is playing a game on a relatively non-serious level and being all the seriousness there is. That's the pawn. The pawn is handled on the board by somebody else. The pawn is not cause. The pawn moves as it is moved by the environment, and that's all it's moved. And it's a very serious pawn. When your life starts to get cut down and the chances, your chances start to get cut down, and the amount of time which you have in order to execute a certain thing gets cut down, that thing becomes serious, doesn't it? That's this one lifespan hallucination. A very serious thing, this one lifespan hallucination. This means it's now or never. And that makes a person almost immediately into a pawn. There are individuals in this world under the concept that this is one life being completely blinked out on both ends of the track and validated out. Who are doing things
dishonorous things, despicable things, unnecessary and harmful things. If they just knew that it was not just one life, they could get right up there into the level of nobility. Okay, shoot me, you mugs. So what? The fellow says, well, if you don't do so and so and so and so and so and so, we're going to shoot you. What threat have they got to offer? They're going to shoot you. Of course, they can also say they're going to shoot you painfully. But that's how serious they can be. You know, I don't think very many individuals would be forced into onerous and despicable courses if it weren't for how serious things were. Now, here's this one button. If you try to run this button, you're going to find out the most serious points of a lifetime. How serious can you get? Death. They're going to be those points which have to do with deep failure on the part of other individuals, or the death of other individuals, or the destruction of possessions, things. In other words, bong. Very serious damage level. That's seriousness. Those are the serious points of a person's life. And it's from those points that he considers it serious and necessary to carry on the life continuum of something or somebody else. How that would be. When he starts in a life, his regret for his last death is usually pretty deep. He's busy regretting while he's dying and all sorts of things. Because he says, well, just as he dies, well, this is the end. And there he is up there, 30,000 feet, looking down at his body, saying, well, there it is. I wonder how I got mixed up about this. I'm still alive. No, I'm not. I'm dead. Let's see, what am I supposed to do now? I don't know. I think somebody comes along about that time and hands you a little red guidebook or something of the sort. But haven't investigated this very thoroughly. But the point is, there is an individual. He starts in fresh, and he doesn't have any commitments in the present environment. But as long as he continues in this environment, he collects commitments or life continuums. He keeps collecting these things. And then he keeps carrying them on. And in view of the fact that Homo sapiens is down there about 1/100th of 1 millimeter above I know not, as far as his concept of himself, his mind, and how he thought was concerned, he hasn't ever questioned this. He's in an interesting state of mind. Somebody comes along and they tell him, you're sick of the hives because of the allergious ramifications of platitudinous strawberries, and the correction for this is anablistamine. It's all physical, all a physical universe. They started telling them recently, the last few decades, and well, it's kind of fashionable to support the church, but actually, in the modern university, you start running to people and you say, is there such a thing as a human soul? And they say, don't be dull, bud. Now, they've gone that far. That's too far. It's about time somebody put a hydraulic jack under the whole works. Because they were out on the clay basis. There is no soul, there is no life, there is no knowledge beyond anything. You have to be taught everything you know. And it is all structurally physical. Nobility, why, man has no nobility. He doesn't have any interest in anybody else but himself. He runs exclusively on the first dynamic. Everybody knows that. Those everybody knows are just wonderful phrases. Everybody knows that everybody runs on the first dynamic. Everybody's out for himself, you know that. Until you start to process somebody and find out that he's out for everybody else but himself. And he's his own worst enemy. If a person is taking himself serious, he is solidly in the line continuum of somebody who is dead, who is not himself. Swallow that one for a minute. B
happy, carefree. Happy, carefree. He goes along. He falls flat in his face. He stumbles. He fails. He goes out. He loses all the football games. He gets nothing but rejection slips. He lives on beans. He wears rags. It's long fine. You still come around and say, you know, life is serious. You ought to go to work. You ought to do this. You say, why? Well, this fellow thought it was worth doing. He'd pitch in and do a bang-up job on something else. But you know where he gets very early in life? He gets the deep responsibility of carrying on for somebody else who is dead. And then he is serious. Then he has to take himself seriously. You see, he isn't himself anymore. Now he has to take this death seriously. He has to take people seriously around him. He's got to take these problems seriously because they're not his problems. He has entrusted himself with them. And in view of the fact that he's entrusted himself with them, he must, of course, take them seriously. And death is a serious thing, and death is as serious as you can get. And if death is very serious, then he has to be very serious. So, of course, he'll fail. But the point is, he moves over there into A's continuum. From that point on, he takes life pretty seriously. Well, who's he taking seriously? B is taking A seriously. He's playing the role for its evaluation in the modern world. And the evaluation in the modern world said, poor old A, he only had one chance. He got born and he had a tough time and he struggled and he tried this and that and he had these few small successes, but he had these ambitions, and then one day he died. And he'll never have another chance. B says, that's rough. Well, here I go. Moves over onto A's line continuum. Here you go. You can put it down in your little book. Anytime an individual takes himself very seriously, he is carrying on the line continuum another individual in this lifetime. Also, that if he carries on very seriously, very, very seriously, he'll be sure to fail, because serious is way down tone. And the way to get this individual straightened out is two ways. Is one, take an assay of his goals, one after the other, find out what these goals amount to, and then find out who had them. And do you know that the individual quite often will be able to just sort himself out sort of in a blur and be very upset for 2 or 3 days, then all of a sudden find out what his own goals are without blowing any grief charges? That's interesting, isn't it? It occasionally happen like this. You have him set up something that looks like this. Name 5 things in the past of which you're afraid. Name 5 goals you had in the past. Have him write those down. Now name 5 things in the present of which you're afraid. Now name 5 things in the present that you're trying to get accomplished on a goal basis that is desirable. Now name 5 things in the future which you would like to do, like to accomplish in the future, and give us 5 fears why you don't think you'll be able to accomplish them. Well, he's all set now. He writes all these things down. He looks over the spheres, these various things. We have a new chart of attitudes. It's got 12 columns, and it's the button chart, actually. It gives you all these buttons and all the gradations of these buttons. But you have him look this thing over at these things he's afraid of, and now you say, now, just a minute. Who else besides yourself might have been afraid of this?
Who else might have wanted to have done this in the past? You take the past category. Whose ambitions were these? He'll occasionally say, mine. Well, don't challenge him. Particularly, they may or may not be his. But one after the other, take those goals, and take those fears, and all of a sudden you say, what's Grandpa Jenkins? Grandpa Jenkins wanted to sell horse liniment. That's why I'm down here on the stand every day selling horse liniment. Well, that's silly. And you know, I've had an awful time selling horse liniment. I'm not able to unload a bottle of it. But of course, I got to do it. But I don't have to do it now. Now you'll all of a sudden find him on a basis of one thing that was a goal and one thing that was fear of his and another person too. And he'll kick off the other person's and think he's kicked off his own. He'll be unhappy for 2 or 3 days, and then all of a sudden he'll revert back onto his own goal. Who is it? This is the game of who is it. Is it me? Or is it A? This is the game of who's dead. And this is the game of, well, now, what was your ambition? I imagine you'll find individuals all broken down. People middle-aged today, because they can't go on manufacturing buggy whips. You'll actually find them with a let's see, what does that field, numismology. The field of numismology calls a thwartation. See, I just made that up. You know, that's pretty good, a thwartation. Hey, let's write a scientific paper on that and sign it, send it off. They'll buy quotations. This being difference from inhibitions. Yeah, they feel like life isn't worthwhile because they can't manufacture buggy whips. And this is Grandpa Smith, who is trying to manufacture buggy whips. And they can't, of course, continue his life because his whole life, everybody said, was in buggy whips. You'll find this is the case. Thwarted ambition, all that sort of thing. You'll get this kind of a situation take place. You'll be able to rehabilitate somebody's goals, somebody's future, on a very simple assay like this, and find them go on doing what they have been doing, although it isn't an ambition of theirs, but they do it about 3 times better. They don't have the responsibility to the dead person for doing a good job. And believe me, there's nobody harder to be responsible to than somebody who has kicked the bucket. You can't go out in the orphan asylums and keep taking every little kid and say, is your name Smorgasbord? No. You can't go down the line through all the maternity wards and say, does anybody here have a child who used to be Joe Smorgasbord? You see, I promised Joe I owe him $5. I ran into a case not very long ago of a little girl. This was reported by a minister. This little girl in a small country community had the most interesting line of chatter. She was quite rational, but every once in a while she'd tell her mother, very sadly, she's only about 5 or 6, so I wonder how my children are doing. And mother would say, you go on out and play with your dolls. Finally, this little girl became very morose, very morose. And then they took her to see the local minister. And the local minister took her back in and asked her. And she was very evasive for a while. You know, a child has an awful time trying to get into communication with low-tone scale people, such as adults. And so finally she figured out she could trust him enough. And she said, well, her name was so-and-so. Her husband's name was so-and-so. Her children's names were so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so. Her address was such-and-such. And she was very worried how he could possibly get along with the children and so forth. She was quite concerned about it. And the minister said, what towns was that? Well, it was only about 100 miles from there. So the little girl was let go home instead of being locked up. And the minister got in his car and he drove up to this town and he made inquiries. Yep, she had died at the hour and minute, the little girl had said. This was her husband. The family wasn't getting along too badly. He'd gotten married again in the ensuing 6-7 years. The children were doing fine. He got all of the data, including how well was her clock being taken care of. The livestock, by name. He got all the data. He took it back home, and he called in the little girl, feeling very, very respectful. And he says, I wanted to tell you, your children are doing fine. And she thanked him so much for all the good news. And she said, all right, then I can forget about it. And she promptly did. And from then on, she went on acting as any other child. Never mentioned the subject again. The minister wrote it into the congregational church headquarters, and it kicked around for quite a while, and it finally appeared over his handwriting in a little booklet on curiosities of this and that. I've had some correspondence with several people who have had this sort of thing turn out. And there are a lot of them, but people know better than to mention them. What is reality? Reality is agreement. What is insanity? Insanity is not agreeing with somebody else's reality. The commonest phrase in the language is, you're crazy. We have a hard enough time agreeing on the fact that every election we're supposed to elect Democrats. We have a hard enough time agreeing on the fact that everybody should have an electric refrigerator. We have a tough time agreeing on the fact that we should all wear pants, the men should wear pants and the women dresses. These are wild points of agreement, by the way, but we've managed them. And we still have, as one of the commonest phrases in our conversation, you're crazy. So somebody comes along and says, particularly a little kid, they're easily sat on, they're small, they fit in a chair easily, you can sit on quite easily. And the little kid starts to tell about a dream he's had. And he says, and I dreamed I was standing there in the crib and a dinosaur stuck its head over it and it bit me in half. That's our idea. It's just your imagination. Let's make sure you're very sleepy and groggy, so this will be hypnotic, and this is just your imagination. Now you understand it? But it's so real! It's just your imagination. Now, they've invented another one. Dream analysis. They've said that if you only tell somebody your dreams, it'll expose all of your second dynamic events. So you mustn't tell anybody your dreams, because then they'll find out. Children's imaginations have to be sat on all the time. You don't let them get away with that stuff. It's too stimulative. So we managed to just turn off the spigot on this line of communication by the time a child is 3, 4, 5, something like that. About the time he learns how to talk, we managed to turn it off. And all I can say is boy, there but a bunch of cowards been dying in the last few generations. They're scared to remember it. Now, it's fascinating that this mechanism going out of valence every time you die, that's, by the way, a nice little pat mechanism. You die, you go out of valence, you know. And it's very interesting going back down the track, clicking back into valence all the way down the line. Painful, too, sometimes. And the point is, But I am almost sure that not too many generations ago, maybe 500 generations ago, you had a direct recall on the whole thing. And then somebody could make a quick buck by turning it off. And they did. But I'm sure that that's the case. I get the spooky feeling every once in a while that this used to be common computation. You used to be sitting around a campfire and you'd say, well, I remember a caribou I shot 75 winters ago. It was up on that river. And he's pretty hard packing him down. And I haven't been up there this high. But you'll find that there's a sort of a ravine there. And if you could manage to slide him into the ravine, you can bring him down the creek. The other hunter says, thanks. Never questions it. Yeah. So something for you to think about. It's sort of creepy when you start thinking about it, though, because you get sure it's there. But what would you be betraying or violating? What would you be violating if you remembered all the way back down the track by straight wire? What would you be violating in the terms of life continuum and living on somebody else's death? Whose integrity would you be violating if you suddenly said there's only one life? Whose goal was it to have only one life? That's something for you to think about. Something for you to think about. Who would you be betraying if you suddenly said, well, I can remember all the way back down the track? Do you know that an individual, we just had an incident of it here, Don's processing a fellow, doing a very good job of it too. He's got a wide open case. He goes back the next day, the next session. The fellow is completely occluded case. One postulate's been made. Don works the fellow for 2.5 hours before he can even start to crack this case again, though. Very upsetting. All of a sudden, just one proposition is going to be made. The gentleman isn't here now. Here's the thing is, I'm afraid you're going to take my blindness away from me. So he turns off all his perceptives. And they all turn on again, according to Don, the moment he finds this postulate and runs it out. What blindness is this man carrying forward? He's carrying forward his brothers. His brothers. Brother dead in an automobile accident. That one he mustn't give up, you see. So he'll turn off all of his perceptics and everything else, louse up his whole case so thoroughly that it can be unloused in about a split second if you find the right postulate. Give you some kind of an idea, maybe a little better answer on what an occluded case is. If this individual were to give up his aberrations, he would be betraying somebody else whose life he is continuing. Somebody comes along and asks him to give up his aberrations. He says, no. Funny part is, he'll give up any of his. And those are the ones you'll get. But he won't give up somebody else's that he's holding for them. These are granted to him in trust. Unless you can find the initial postulates on the thing, you're going to have an awful rough time. Sympathy is one of the ways you get into it. Running the emotional curve is another one. Postulates turn up out of these things, and also by running effort itself. All right. Maybe you know a little bit more about cases. Maybe you know about a little bit more about people now. I know these studies in the last, particularly the last few weeks, have gelled remarkably. Simplification has been quite remarkable. Also, the method of doing this has become
much simplified. I don't want to overrate this workbook because it may take more work by the auditor than I think it will. But this workbook makes it possible for the auditor to pilot down these 15 acts with much less ardor. Auditing is more of a consulting basis. They ask you, what is meant by this, and how does that work? And maybe you say, well, they say, I don't get anything about this lock scanning myself. I just can't seem to get it. You find out if they can lock scan or not. Fix them up, run a curve for them, show them what curve it is, demonstrate them. Demonstrating, you like to do that, that's fun. Sitting down there with phrase by phrase, hour after hour, that's not so good. If you could be sure that you're only going to have to audit a case 15 to 25 hours with deep on the couch processing, you'd be very happy to tackle any case that walked up to you. I know that. 15, 25 hours. You knew at the end of that time you'd have finished the case. If somebody asks you to keep on going and you look ahead down the track and you see 500 hours on this line, you have qualms. Well, maybe, and I'm just maybe, it's down to a point where if you suddenly advise somebody what you can do and what exists, you can just give them a copy of this book, answer a few questions for them, maybe take an hour of your time, and they are all of a sudden well. Although they'll kick you in the teeth later because you tried to help them, I'm sure you'd like to do that. That's what we've been trying to move toward. You might find it's a little bit of fun to carry forward the process which I gave you tonight of the assay of five fears and five goals of the past, five fears, five goals of the present, five fears, five goals of the future, and then tie them up with other people who are no longer in our midst or who are in our midst and have failed badly. Why don't you try it? Now next Monday night, where is that joint? Wichita University.
It's not an open meeting.
It isn't? Who said it was? Well, lecturers and television artists, of which I am a member, subdivision of the Authors Guild of America, says the closed meeting requires certain fees, and I don't think those people got $1,500. I'd get in bad with my union. I won't talk at a closed meeting, Tom. That's right, I won't. That's nonsense. It's nonsense, my going over there. You think I'm joking? Listen, I spent 10 consecutive evenings in Washington, D.C., talking to the superstrata of the upper crust of the higher of the Witcher in the field of, as they humorously called it, mental healing. The best they had. We had a crew of auditors upstairs who were instructing them and processing them after they had listened to a little introductory talk. Sort of an easy talk, like the goal of life is survival. Man has several dynamics. He's not just interested in himself. You get to that point, every evening when I give this talk, it was the same talk. Somebody was supposed to go on up, they were supposed to go on then and see how auditing was done. And they never moved out of the front room. And every evening I had the argument. Well, how do you know that man is only interested? Now, according to Jung, then I get a bunch of unproven, unsubstantiated opinions which have nothing to do with phenomena. And I try to explain the difference between phenomena and opinion.
Rita Fromm Reichman, one of those meetings one night, turned around to a doctor of biology. She says, "Please, doctor, please tell me that the baby cannot hear in the womb." So he told her. She was happy, only he didn't know. But he told her. Matter of fact, a doctor in practice who is on the ball knows very well that you can hear a baby cry through a stethoscope. I mean, that's easy. And that you very often, before a baby is born, can hear the baby cry without any stethoscope or anything else. But mothers are quite often very startled. Sorry, folks. They never even knew the phenomenon of extended hearing. Anytime an individual is very frightened, an individual gets extended hearing. Bing! You can take common hypnotism. You can extend a person's hearing just by hypnotic command to a point where he'll hear a bus coming two or three blocks before you hear it coming. Yet his hearing is normal under normal conditions. You can check this up. You can set it up as exact experiments, extended hearing. Well, this is one of the oldest wheezes known to charlatans and quacks of the mind. Extended hearing. These boys didn't know it. So at the end of that 10 days, I said, "I'm sorry I came to Washington." I converted one boy, Dr. Ben Weininger. Dr. Ben Weininger, occasionally, even today, sends a preclear or something around. He recommends Dianetics to people. It's not for him because he and I have an understanding. I happen to know more about mysticism than his mentor, Krishnamurti, knows. I'm a better mystic than Krishnamurti. That makes me an awful lousy mystic, by the way. But this was the open sesame. I wasted those days. Ever since this time, I've just said, well, it's wasted time. You know what we're going to do now? Just for the benefit of future program here at the foundation. People see in terms of black and white. Yes, no, Ken can't. If a person can't see and all of a sudden he can see, they know something has happened. Aristotle laid this down. They believed it ever since. We're going to carry forward an unpaid research program here, working as hard as we can to get people, for instance, in a wheelchair with arthritis, people that are blind but have not had their eye pupils removed, so on. That type of case, where it's a complete shutoff, we're going to turn it up. All right. Take these people on as a research program. Now, I personally do not know how many blind people, 100 blind people, how many of those people are going to see again. I don't know whether it's going to be 10, 20, 50. I don't know. It's not been possible for us to undertake research of any broad magnitude of this character because it's fantastically expensive. And everybody knows research money in the United States goes to people who can sit around in chairs, who read papers by other people who are sitting around in chairs, who pass the papers on to other people who are sitting around in chairs, and they attend all the society meetings and they keep the records and files straight. That's research in the United States.
That's crude, but true.
And you hire a boy at one of these foundation research programs, I mean, in college or something of the sort, they turn out very well. We've got this self-help book. Well, it permits a research program to go forward broadly for the first time. Our techniques and understanding of this are apparently broad enough now so that they can be laid down in this form, making minimal number of auditing hours. All we're going to try to do is turn out some miracles. That's all. Foundation is now specializing in miracles. If you know anybody that needs a miracle, I don't mean the person's dying so we keep him up living. That's not a miracle. The public can always say, well, he probably would have lived anyway. But it's not kin or can't. But just on this basis of anything comes under the heading of miracle, we can probably do it here very easily. And we'll just turn these out. And then the beacon can go on printing perjury and, well, that's all right. Everybody that works on the Beacon knows the Beacon prints like practically nothing, but they can go on yakking at the AMA, and they can do all sorts of things. You know, an awful lot of physicians in this town, medical doctors, are very definitely, they've got an eye on the foundation, which is very interesting. Somebody goes in for a treatment or penicillin shot or something, sort of mentions they're even vaguely connected with Dianetics. This fellow, sort of underneath the blotter, says, well, you know, I'm very interested in it. I know about past lives, too. I've seen too many of my patients do strange things. There must be some kind of an answer to this sort of thing. We had a fight about it up at the hospital yesterday. Yeah, just yesterday they were fighting about it.